I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Prosecutors in the Justice Department's Public Integrity Section indicted Pennsylvania State Senator Larry Farnese last week and committee woman Ellen Chapman. They're charged with conspiracy, mail fraud, wire fraud, and violations of the Travel Act. The feds allege that Farnese paid $6,000 from a campaign fund to Bard College, where Chapman's daughter was a student, to help pay for a study abroad program in exchange for a favorable vote in 2011 for ward leader. Complicated, I know. Farnese's lawyer said he did nothing wrong. Today on Radio Times, we want to talk about campaign donations and campaign spending and things like bribery and politicking. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Tom Farrick is an independent journalist. He writes for a city and state magazine. He's also been writing for the Philadelphia Daily News. And Tom Farrick, nice to have you back with us on the air.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is William J. Brennan, and he's a pretty well-known veteran Philadelphia criminal defense lawyer. And Bill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as
well.
Thanks
for having me, Marty.
You know, Tom, I have to say it was your article that we read in Philly.com that got us thinking about this.
Right. That was an editorial.
An editorial, mm-hmm. Exactly. So I don't want to spend a whole hour, 40 minutes talking about the Farnese case, and we should say he's innocent, obviously, until proved guilty.
Right.
But nonetheless, what was it about this that got you thinking?
Well, it got me thinking because, first of all, to the normal person, you'd say, what's a state senator in Pennsylvania doing giving a $6,000 donation to a college in New York? And the answer to that question is because he can. I mean, under our state campaign finance law, anything goes, basically. If you decide that it's a political thing, it's a political thing. If you want to call it a donation, it's a donation. If you wanted to call it tuition, even that would be legal, although that's not permitted. So our law that governs, and I put that, you can't see the quotes around that.
No, I see them. Yes.
Campaign finance dates back to 1978, and you know, that's when Jimmy Carter was president and Laverne Shirley was number one, and things have changed, but the law has not changed. And it was never meant to be an enforcement law. It's mostly a disclosure law. So it needs to be changed.
And you said disclosure law. The way it works now is basically whatever is spent is disclosed.
Correct.
And that's the idea of what, sunlight as a disinfectant?
Yes, exactly. But there's no limit on contributions, no limit on the amount of money you could take. There's really no definite. It says for political purposes, which could be anything. So, and in fact, it's just been interpreted that way over the years by the practice of politicians.
Let me turn to you, Bill. And one of the arguments, I think, against the prosecutors is this is just yet one more example of overreach, of an essentially criminalizing political behavior. This is what politicians do. They spend money, they wine and dine people, and this is the feds getting involved in some pretty basic politics.
Marty, I agree. I think that this is fairly hyper-technical. It's my understanding that in Philadelphia, the position of committee person is put to the voters on the ballot, and that is an elected office. But the position of ward leader is kind of an inside baseball, so to speak, position where the elected committee people elect their leader, similar to, I guess, if you're in the scouts, you have a scoutmaster. I think you can make the argument in this particular case, the Farnese case, that it's my understanding that the 78 law, which hasn't really been amended with any great radical changes, allows money spent. I think the actual wording is for the purpose of influencing the outcome of an election. This was money spent. It was disclosed. And even if you take the Fed's version, it was to influence the outcome of an election. Now, that may be a stretch, but if you pay the money and you disclose it, I mean, unless it's off the charts, if it's for a new Porsche or if it's for, you know,
some
a vacation
big ticket
home,
item.
Or a vacation home, something just that you can't justify, I think you can make the argument now that you're not mm-hmm. outside the law.
Well, picking up on that, Tom, I mean, and again, I don't want to get too mired in the weeds here, but based on the fact that in Pennsylvania, you can give unlimited amounts of money, maybe not directly to candidates, but you can certainly funnel money to them. Are there questions about whether, in your mind, the feds are criminalizing something that's kind of business as usual?
Well, first of all, I have to say, Bill, it's the first time I've ever heard ward leaders referred to as Boy Scouts, Boy Scout leaders.
It's all in the perspective, Tom.
But this is unpaid, right?
I know, it is an unpaid position.
Okay. Gotcha.
But I think the difference is this was not for political this was for a political purpose, but it essentially was a bribe. I mean, I could spend money as a candidate to have you go out and work on my behalf. I could give you $200 in street money, but I can't give you $100 to vote for me. And that's the difference. And that's where the bribery issue comes in on this. And the feds believe he overstepped that line.
Well, there's always this question about quid pro quo. I mean, how do you prove that someone, a politician, an elected official, gives money to somebody in return for them doing something as a favor? I mean, I'm looking at you, Tom.
Oh,
I think
you have to establish the case through testimony. You know, I mean, you have to have someone get up there and say, yes, this is the circumstances under which I took it, and I wanted this, and he got this for me, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know what the testimony is going to be.
Right.
But that's usually the way you get it, is through putting out facts and testimony.
Quid pro quo. How do you prove that, Bill?
Well, Marty, that's really the salient point, because there are certain criminal statutes that the feds can bring, bribery, extortion, things like that. But there's and it used to be fairly arcane, but then it became almost commonplace in corruption cases to be charged with honest services fraud. And that particular statute was during the waning years of the Reagan administration. I believe that was enacted in 88. That was a very far-reaching, wide-ranging tool for prosecutors to use anytime the federal government felt. And there was a public service sector component and a private component. Anytime the government felt that someone was not giving either their shareholders or their constituents the value of their honest services. And then a case came down called Skilling. It involved the former CEO of Enron, where
I remember that well.
It was a major case where the court said, I believe it was a 6-3 opinion. Three dissenters led by now the late Justice Scalia saying we should just completely abolish the law, and six saying, well, no, we're not going to do that, but we're going to say there has to be quid pro quo. There has to be something of value. And that changed things drastically. And after that, certain cases were either – cases that were pending actually had charges either taken out or amended. I think Governor Blagojevich had his case pending at the time. And I recently was one of a team – not a team, but many lawyers who tried the Philadelphia Traffic Court case where judges were indicted. And honest services was not charged there because in the case, at least with my judge, my former judge, there was just nothing of value, not a Phillies ticket, not a glass of Cabernet, not a dollar.
So the question is, you know, what in terms of what transpires, and let me go back to you, Tom, then, and going back to this 1978 law, you're saying it's just too loose. It's transparency, sunlight disinfectant is not enough. How should this be changed, you think?
Well, I think there's a variety of ways you could do it, and a lot have been proposed over the last 30 years in the legislature, but they've never gotten anywhere. There is a bill right now, for instance, in the legislature to limit the amount of campaign contributions. You know, we have that limit in Philadelphia,
yes,
but not statewide.
Yes.
If I wanted to write you a check for $1 million, that's fine. So that's one thing, is not make the stakes so high. The second thing you could do is require more documentation to be disclosed. For instance, to use Larry Farnese as an example, if you look at his campaign finance reports in 2014, which is sort of a sample year, he spent about $2,500 a month on what he called card member services. Well, obviously that was a credit card. Now, you could argue that was all for political purposes, but I'd like to know more detail than card member services.
Well, like literally.
Yeah, literally a purpose. And now I could call, under the law, I have the right to call and ask for those receipts.
Right.
And they have to give them to me, not as a journalist, but as a member of the public. And I have done that in the past. But that's who's going to take that step? Not many. Also, the State Department is the enforcer, but they have no enforcement ability. They don't have the money. They don't have the people. They don't have the way the State Department enforces, for instance, campaign finance laws is it does a random audit of 3% of all the reports filed. That's just probably as many thousands of reports filed in a year. That's random. Now, what would happen if the IRS said to you, we're only going to audit 3% of all the returns, and we're going to pick them at random? Would that have an influence on your behavior? It might mine, because I'm thinking, well, the odds of me getting audited are near zero.
Right. So you're saying
those are two examples.
Toothless.
Yeah, toothless. Yeah.
But do you think, to you, Bill, that the prosecutors, first of all, that they're digging deep into the politics of Philadelphia, that they are deploying themselves perhaps more aggressively than they did in the past, and that there are even more of them who are doing this kind of work?
No doubt in my mind about that, Marty. If we look back over, let's say the last, since 78 has come up by virtue of when this particular law was enacted, if we go back to the mid to late 70s and look at the major corruption prosecutions, we had the roofers prosecution when Local 30 and 30B went to indictment, and that was a major, major prosecution. I mean, I guess if you went back further, you could go to around that time, you could also give Abscam.
Right.
There's now, I think, a almost zero tolerance position by the office here in the Eastern District. They do a good job, but they're somewhat top heavy as far as personnel. In 1969, there was about 20 attorneys over at the office. Now there's hundreds, and it gives them more time and more manpower to prosecute cases. So I do think that a byproduct of that could be you see a state senator indicted for something that happened 5 or 6 years ago, not for his election to the Senate, but for his election as ward leader. So I think that, that's kind of the new face of prosecution in Philadelphia, because there's such a focus and, frankly, such almost unlimited resources to go after it.
Tom,
let me
flip
the coin on that. I mean, I think one of the reasons that the Fed – well, first of all, Seth Williams really did an amazing thing last year. He indicted Philadelphia politicians.
District attorney,
District
yes.
attorney Seth yes. Williams, and that was on a case that was deep six by the attorney general. Name a state prosecution – a state prosecution or a city prosecution of a politician. There aren't many, if any. The DA's office, whenever it receives complaints, and this is not true in this case, but previously, would refer all those cases to the attorney general because they would argue, well, I'm politically endorsed, I'm a political, you know. And so they wouldn't do it. And the state election bureau didn't have the resources. And let me just say that even when you're aggressive on this, as it has been in the past, most of these crimes, quote unquote, not referring to this bribery, alleged bribery, are misdemeanors. You get a fine. So what's the story? Why bother? You know?
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tom Farrick. He's been a longtime journalist here in Philadelphia. He writes now for City and State magazine. He's also been writing with the Philadelphia Daily News, had an op-ed recently that caught our eye. Also with us is Bill Brennan, and he's a longtime Philadelphia criminal defense lawyer. And you can join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email to join the conversation as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join the conversation. Much more after this. Excuse me, after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about a whole bunch of things with our guests, Bill Brennan and Tom Farrick, quid pro quo when it comes to money and politics. And we want you to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Tom, I'm looking at something that John Baer wrote recently in the Philadelphia Daily News. He said, this was, I think, last week. He said he talked about Philadelphia lawyer Esty pleading guilty to pocketing $13,000 during an elaborate sting. Farnese, that we had talked about, these are allegations, and he talks about eight legislative leaders imprisoned in 2012. We've got Rob McCord, the state's treasurer, who has pled guilty to attempted extortion. We've got Congressman Chaka Fattah. He's now on trial. Is Philadelphia, maybe Pennsylvania, corrupt and contented, to quote Lincoln Steffens?
Well, I don't...
Or is this people doing their jobs?
Not people doing their jobs.
Well, I mean by going after them.
I don't think the political culture of 2016 is all that much different from 1976 or, for that matter, 1876. What may be different are the enforcement mechanisms and the attention that's paid to them. In the city, for instance, we've done a really good job. And I think Michael Nutter, that we have a board of ethics, we have an investigative, you know, what is the name of the AIG, the, you know, Office of Investigator General. They look into these things. And what the overall effect is, you know that someone's looking over your shoulder. And you know that you're going to get fined if they find you. And so you want to keep the straight and narrow. And I think that's good. We don't have that in the state.
And that's, I mean, obviously, and I think people might be surprised to think that Philadelphia is a little bit tougher on this stuff than the state is.
Well, we had that whole pay-to-play, the quid and the pro and the quo under Mayor Street. I mean, there was a big conversation about that. There was a big federal investigation. They indicted a number of people. And I think that Michael and others ran on, had an impetus for reform. Let's put it that way. And so they were able to get that stuff through.
Bill, we were talking about this during the break, and one of the thoughts that I had was just sometimes when you look at what people have either been found guilty of or admitted doing, it's such small amounts of money. It's so sort of low level, if you know what I mean. What are we supposed to make of that? I mean, maybe we should be more shocked that we're not hearing about people getting $250,000 worth of something. But it's even with Vince Fumo, I remember reading about vacuum cleaners, things like that.
Tiki lamps.
Tiki lamps, yes, exactly.
Well, I know that the press made great hay in the Fumo case about OPM, other people's money, and I think that that phrase had come out quite a bit. But it did. I think that, and I don't want to single anybody out, but I think that if you are ingrained in a culture of not spending your own money, or, you know, using public funds or campaign funds or donor funds, it gets to be a mindset. And then there becomes the alligator arms syndrome, where you just have the inability to reach into your own pocket. Mm. And that becomes a problem. And I think that's what results in the convictions that appear petty by virtue of the fact that it's a $20 item or it's a $200 Sawzall. But there's 50 of them, or it's been 20 years of Sawzalls, and that's the problem.
What's an alligator arm?
An alligator arm is, if you see an alligator, it has very short arms.
Yeah.
That's when your arms cannot reach your pocket. And I think that is sometimes what is the effect of 15, 20, 25 years of spending other people's money. You
plus
cannot reach your own pocket.
Plus, there's a sense of entitlement in this way. You can almost get inside their head and say, you know, I work tirelessly for these people. Mm. I don't get paid very well. I have all this money. I might as well just take advantage. Mm. I mean, take advantage of that, not of them, because it's not taxpayer money. In this case, it was campaign finance money and money he had for Citizens Alliance, which mm-hmm. was based on a settlement of a lawsuit. So, but you just lose your sense of perspective that way.
But where do you draw the line when it comes to something like constituent service or sort of abusing the ability to provide services for friends or people that might be able to help you out? I mean, where is that line?
Well, in the federal government, they have something called the Federal Election Commission that helps draw that line. And if you are a politician with a question, you can write to them. Also, they have a provision. I mean, you could write for an advisory opinion, excuse me. They also have a provision in the federal law that says that your money or campaign money is not to be used for personal purposes. Now, what is that? And they give examples of it. If someone is using the money to put an alarm system in their house, and they would have otherwise, then that's misuse. If they're doing it because they received death threats, you know, that's a different matter. So even the federal law is fairly permissive. Like, they can give donations in any amount, but they can't give it for college tuition. In other words, there are all little crevices there. You can make any amount donation to a charity unless you are part of the group that is the charity.
Hmm.
So, but we don't have that in Pennsylvania. We don't, and we're not, and you know, a lot of states do have some of these oversight regulations.
You want to add to that, Bill?
Marty, I agree with Tom, but Tom's speaking on a macro level. The public officials that I've represented that have been indicted or charged with ethics violations, I see more on a micro level. I think Tom's point is well taken, that there is sometimes a mentality that look at all that I'm doing for my district, or those with seniority, look at all that I'm bringing into my district. And I think, frankly, and the Federal Election Commission is great and these ethics boards are great, but what people in power really need, I just watched recently Citizen Kane. And there was that character Jedediah, played by Joseph Cotton. Mm-hmm. And he was the guy that would just get in Kane's face and say, Charlie, what are you doing? It's wrong. You need somebody around you who will speak truth to power. You need somebody around you who's not a yes man who will say, hey, Senator, knock it off. It doesn't smell right. It doesn't pass the smell test. And unfortunately, people in power don't have enough people like that around them. That might be a very basic solution, if we will, but that's what I see as somebody who represents people who are charged with crimes.
Someone who's sort of a no man as opposed to a yes man.
Right. You need a no man out there.
You agree with that, Tom?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, but on the other hand, I've seen plenty of examples. But first of all, speaking truth to power, it's not a very popular habit, but can get you killed in some countries. But
hopefully not this one.
Yeah, no. No, I think I think we're okay so far, but stick around. But Senator Leanna Washington, I think, was basically indicted and convicted for using all sorts of state money for her private fundraising efforts. And she had a lawyer who went to, or staff member who went to state ethics training, came back from that and said, you can't do this anymore. This is not right. This is not legal. And she said, don't tell me what to do. I'm the blankety blank senator. Hmm. And continued to do it. Now, her crime as much was stupidity than it was avarice or anything like that. But she just decided, I'm not going to pay attention to the law. And of course, that had consequences because she was indicted found guilty. So,
let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Tom Farrick, who joins us along with Bill Brennan, talking about things like quid pro quo, about money and politics, how some elected officials have gotten caught up in some of the problems of money and politics. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I see some comments coming in. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get John from, looks like Roxbury, to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you. I heard one of the gentlemen, comment. I believe it was Thomas, said they don't make very much money, the elected officials. I have to say that I could take strong disagreement with that. $89,000 for a part-time job, a state rep, $150 a day per diem. We're one of the few legislatures, a state legislator, that has a full-time. And it really can be done part-time. And then in city council, you're looking at $120,000. Also, you can hold another private sector job. These are very well-paying jobs compared to a median household income, $37,000 in the city.
Yeah, no.
I think that needs to be cleared up.
No, John, I appreciate the call.
That's a good point.
And, Tom, go ahead.
They do get paid well. What I was referring to is their perception that they're not paid enough for the work that they do. And they feel, a little bit more entitled. There is something I want to talk about, though, that was something that you had to deal with. That is the prosecution of the traffic court judges. They were prosecuted not for taking bribes, as you recall, but for fixing tickets.
That's right.
And their defense was, and you can say better than I, that yes, we did, but that was part of the job.
Tom, that pretty much sums it up. We took a fairly risky and aggressive position in that the phrase that was used was consideration given. And it was the collective thought of the lawyers who represented each individual judge that there's just no way to deny this. But since nothing of value was given, we have to just kind of acknowledge the elephant in the room and say, sure, consideration was given. But a big part of the defense was whether a ward leader called traffic court on your behalf or you walked in on your own, you pretty much got the same result. We had charts and graphs and data that showed that. And jurors who were interviewed after, I read in the paper, your former paper, that they said that they were appalled by the violations that they found ethically challenging, but they didn't think it was enough to violate criminal law. And the proof in the pudding is those who were convicted, every judge was acquitted, found not guilty of corruption, but anyone who spoke to the FBI or spoke to the grand jury was convicted for lying.
Traffic court exists no more.
No, so that's right. It's gone.
It's gone. Yeah. Just so people know. We could go down the rabbit hole of traffic court, but go ahead, Tom.
But the reason I brought it up is that I think if I were a traffic court judge, I would say, look, I'm a cog in the machine. I didn't create this system. I maintain it. But this is the way things operate. And therefore, it's part of the culture. And at a certain point, you have to say, well, it's not part of the legal culture to treat people differently right. just because of their connections. It also raises an interesting and unanswered question about if they were cogs, if they were pawns, who was the king?
Well, I mean, it's hard to change anything. Changing a culture sometimes takes, if not generations, centuries, maybe never, Tom. I mean, culture.
Are you speaking
really
personally?
No, well, just from my many years on this planet. It's hard to change a culture. Let me get Frank from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
There.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Go ahead.
My question is very straightforward, simple. How can a ward leader not be affected by a donation to her daughter's tuition in a college, even if the two people involved are the same party and trying to do this quote unquote the right thing? It makes for a compromise that is just very apparent to me, even under the best of intentions. It totally weakens the ward leader's independence, if you will, and also the senator's ability to not use that in some way that's not in the best interest of how politics or good government should run. I mean, it's just
sure.
a very straightforward.
No,
question.
It's a good one, Frank. Let me put that to Bill Brennan.
Well, it's my, and I don't want to get in the weeds on the Farnese matter because it's important to remember that Senator Farnese is presumed innocent.
Absolutely.
He has a fine lawyer, and I'm sure they'll do a great job. But my understanding is that, that it wasn't that money was given to a ward leader. It was a person, may have been a committee person, Farnese was attempting to secure the job of ward leader, which I think he may have gotten without opposition. It may have been a unanimous vote. But the federal government is charged that this, I think it was on page 50 of his report, this quote-unquote donation to Bard College was actually a quid pro quo in favor of his obtaining another woman, I think the person is Chapman, of that person's vote. That's what it seems to be.
Well, and Tom, this is a case also that goes back to 2011. And, you know, one wonders what takes 5 years.
Well,
is that a problem?
Well, justice grinds slow but exceedingly fine, and the cases in the federal system and in the state system have ground on for years. Yet it is also a possibility that they didn't hear about this until several years after the fact. But I think it's within the statute of limitations, obviously.
An email from VR says, why does the GOP not capitalize on the corruption of the Philadelphia Democratic Party hacks 65 years of crooks? Well, you're both looking at each other, but Tom, let me toss that back to you.
Well, because there's no Republican Party. the Republican Party has been in decline. Its infrastructure is weak. It finds difficult in raising money. We are de facto a one-party city, and I'd love to have a vigorous, and I think those are the people who keep the incumbents honest, but they just haven't managed to have that happen since maybe Ron Castile was elected.
Yeah. I mean, the need for a two-party system, do you think, Bill, that keeps parties less corrupt?
Well, I think certainly – I think that's a separate issue, but I think certainly the need for a two-party system similar to checks and balances in our government is always present. But Tom's point, again, is well taken. This is a Democratic town.
Mm-hmm.
If you went to the Midwest and found a town that was the 180 of us, that was a Republican town, you'd find it there. My experience with the corruption is it does not discriminate. Happens to be the Democrats here because we're a Democratic town, but it's not assigned to or the province of one party.
Let me read a tweet from Walt. I'll put this back to you, Bill. He says, Tom Corbett, as Attorney General, invented the crime theft of services to prosecute his way to being governor, taking out D's and R's in his way. True, not true?
Not exactly true. He may General Corbett may have employed that statute more aggressively than his predecessors, but theft of services has been around for a long time.
Anything you want to add to that, Tom?
No, although I was thinking of there is an aspect of culture. I know that when I was at the Inquirer, we had an editor who came in from Minnesota. And it was at the same time, you may recall this story, it's fairly small, Angel Ortiz was discovered that he had no driver's license for about 4 years, and he claimed he had misread the... And I was a columnist, and the editor came up to me and said, well, I guess that's the end of Ortiz. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, they're going to throw him out of council. And I said, Walker, they'll be lucky if they don't give him a commendatory resolution. We don't do that around here. He said, well, in Minnesota, he'd be gone in a day. So we do have a different culture to a certain degree. We're more accepting.
Well, Tom, am I having a false memory? Or I just was thinking about Mayor Barry from D.C., who was caught on tape smoking crack, saying, B-word set me up. Yeah. Wasn't he reelected? Didn't he become mayor again?
Later.
Yeah.
He was. It's like the Good Wife.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but Tom, just to underscore something you said earlier, that under Mayor Michael Nutter,
right,
there has been some cleanup here in Philadelphia.
Yes, there's an infrastructure. There are people investigating. There's people who are active in making sure deadlines are met. I think we have a good infrastructure in the city. In fact, I don't know what I'd do to improve it. I just like to see it applied in the state.
Well, what's the chance of that happening, do you think?
Let's see. About the chance of Angel Ortiz being thrown out of city council. Well, where's the motivation? You are a politician. You are the one in power. Do you have a motive to change other than sort of general idea of reform? No. They protect themselves. So,
Marty, Mayor Nutter was smart, though, in that he grabbed an assistant U.S. attorney named Amy Curland,
yeah,
from this district here,
yep,
who was a veteran prosecutor in cases like this, and he made her the kind of the inspector general. And she's terrific, and she did a great job. He really went into the fox den to save the hen house. It was a brilliant move.
Well, we're going to end on that happy note. My thanks to both of you for joining
Thank
us
you.
Today on Radio Times. William Brennan, Philadelphia criminal defense lawyer Tom Farrick. He writes for City and State magazine. And after this very short break, Radio Times producer John Ahrens talking with Thomas Frank about his new book. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. The 2016 presidential election has illuminated the American people's frustration with our political system. In his new book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, Thomas Frank looks at the policies of the Democrats from FDR to today. He told Radio Times producer John Ahrens that the party has abandoned the middle class in recent years.
Well, I was thinking Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, you know, the Democrats of the post-war decades and the Great Depression, who always talked about the middle class and working people. And what's striking is how, although Democrats today often say, you know, similar things to those old-fashioned Democrats, the group that they really care about the most is very different.
And when did they move away from these ideals, or when did they stop being the party of the people?
What's fascinating is that you can actually trace that. They were very open about what they were doing, and they wrote about it and talked about it and theorized it and strategized it and did it. And it begins in the late 60s and early 70s with the Vietnam War and with all of the protests and anger over that. And the Democrats decided to reorganize their party and remove organized labor from its sort of structural role within the party. And to sort of reach out and embrace a different group instead, and that group was white-collar professionals. What's fascinating, though, is that the Democrats stuck with it and developed all of these sort of complete theories of history to explain why this, the white-collar professional class was going to be the winners in history and why this was the group you had to embrace.
And do you see this move as a political one, or, like, do you see it as them actually still trying to cater to working people in an idealistic way?
There's all sorts of idealism involved in this, but it's idealism of a different kind. It's not idealism of the sort of Labor Day variety, the salt of the earth, these are the people who built America. It's not that. It's idealism. President Obama gives you a perfect example of it. You look at his State of the Union speeches where he talks about innovation all the time. Or when these people talk about the creative class, they're extremely idealistic about this group of people. You know, when Hillary Clinton says that it's not like Goldman Sachs, they didn't bribe me, I can't be bought by, you know, people don't know me. She's absolutely right. It's not like this relationship of the Democrats and Wall Street isn't one where Wall Street is just buying them off. These people are in love. This is idealism.
But, I mean, the reality is from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, when they were sort of turning their back on sort of FDR politics, the reality is we did become a post-industrial country. To me, it seems like it would make sense to try to adapt to a new economy.
Sure, but you got to remember politics also makes the economy. So what you decide to adapt to is what, you know, what actually happens. Let's start with globalization.
Sure.
Okay, so because politicians and especially Democrats love to talk about globalization. And what they mean when they use that phrase is that globalization, this great overwhelming economic force that we can't even really begin to comprehend, is what came down to your industry and you know, your town and deindustrialized it, and what cost you your job. It was this majestic power of the entire globe. If you look at it, you know, NAFTA, for example, is 2,000 pages long. God didn't write that. Lobbyists wrote that. The Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is written by who the Democrats decided got a seat at the table. And those people wrote that treaty in their own interests and to ruin other classes of humans. And then they say, well, that's just globalization. You know, all that stuff that just happened to you, nothing we can do about it. It's just globalization.
Going back to Bill Clinton, you sort of point to him as a prime example of the shift away from democratic values. I mean, he's well known for having shifted to the center. And you know, my father is one of these bring back Bill people. Why do you think that sentiment is still so popular?
Well, people don't remember what he actually did. They remember the last 3 years of his presidency, which were good times. Doing the research on Bill Clinton, I had to go back and read what he actually accomplished as president and what his followers and admirers thought was great about his presidency. And there were five things that he did that they admired. I'm going to go down the list. First one was NAFTA. Then there was the crime bill of 1994. Then there was welfare reform. And there was deregulation of both banks and telecoms and a little bit of energy as well. And then the last thing was he balanced the budget. All of those except for the last one are unmitigated disasters. I mean, you think about it, NAFTA. This is deindustrialization all at once. This is it. The crime bill, this is what put a generation of black kids in mass incarceration. Welfare reform, this is strictly about disciplining people who work for a living, pulling out the floor from under them, making them desperate, and then deregulation of Wall Street. So while all these other things are going on, things like NAFTA, you know, and welfare reform that are designed to make workers much more insecure, at the same time, you're literally rolling back the rules for Wall Street. So yeah, there was a stock market bubble. There was a hell of a stock market bubble. But that's not a, you know, really good basis for prosperity. And we often remember him as, you know, as good times, because during that bubble, the economy was so heated up. And yes, wages did increase for 3 years in the Clinton administration, which was, hey, that was really, really good.
And unemployment was way down.
Unemployment was way down. It was, those last 3 years were good times. However, it was a bubble. I mean, we don't celebrate Calvin Coolidge as the greatest president, right? We don't, you know, but he did leave office before the bubble burst, right? That was Hoover. We blame Hoover. We don't blame Coolidge. But with Clinton, it's easier to separate the man from what he did, because the bubble really only burst once George W. Bush was in the White House. And there's one thing that we don't remember about the Clinton years. Clinton and Gingrich in 97 had a series of secret meetings in the White House where they decided on how to privatize Social Security. They came to an agreement. They agreed on a deal. Gingrich had the votes. Clinton would sign it. And they started on it. Clinton even went through with the first step, which was to announce it in his 1998 State of the Union address. And then the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke and the whole thing
right.
Just got dropped immediately, you know, in the rush to impeach him.
How come you decided not to focus on these policies or these strategies being a reaction to whatever the GOP was doing?
I mean, of course, it is everything. And, you know, we have a two-party system. Everything done by one party is in reaction to or, you know, a dance with the other party. That's just the way the system works here. And one of the things that really struck me about the Democrats, it may even have been the idea that got me started on this project in the first place, was their extraordinary longing for consensus with the Republicans. Why do they do this? And this is unique to them. The Republicans don't long for consensus with the Democrats. I mean, they'll say they want a bipartisan, solution. They say that all the time. But the way they act, they really don't care about that. But Democrats do. This is a passion for them that is not shared by other people or the other party.
One of the things that you point to as an example of catering to the professional class and to white-collar people and to academia is that President Obama, when elected, almost exclusively chose people with Ivy League degrees for his cabinet. Yeah. And you have a problem with that. But what's the alternative?
This is a fascinating question because I'm a great believer in expertise in government. Mm-hmm. I think government should be run by people that know what they're doing. That's one lesson we took away from the George W. Bush years, is that you don't put hacks and cronies in charge of FEMA, right? And so I'm a great believer in government by experts. And here's Barack Obama comes in and brings in, the most concentrated set of academic credentials ever seen. What has changed over the years is that professionals don't think of themselves as servants of ordinary people anymore, or as a group that has our interests at heart, but rather as a group that acts in their own interest, and that's a very different thing. But so when I'm wondering about this question, to get back to what you asked, and when did government by expert actually work? There has been a time when it worked. And that time was the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's administration, what they used to call the Brain Trust. We look back as one of the most successful administrations of all time. And so I started studying that and wondering if there was a really obvious difference between what Roosevelt did and what Obama did. But if you look at the people that they brought in to advise them, you start to notice differences very quickly. Roosevelt took people from all over the country, all over the social map, from all different walks of life, as long as they were good at what they did. His innermost circle of advisors were not unusually well-credentialed people. You look at, say, Harry Hopkins, who was his right-hand man during World War II. Hopkins was a social worker from Iowa. Or you look at his Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, very famous. He made him vice president eventually. Wallace went to Iowa State and came to government after editing a magazine for farmers.
So it seems like a keen eye for talent, irrespective of their degree.
Exactly. Right. And they're coming from places that aren't part of the establishment. And there's an important word here, which is orthodoxy. All of these people are really unorthodox. Roosevelt, of course, did have a contingent of Harvard guys. One of them was Galbraith, John Kenneth Galbraith, who helped to run the Office of Price Administration during the war. Galbraith spent his entire life fighting what he used to call conventional wisdom. Right? These are the kind of people that Roosevelt brought in. Obama's people are conventional wisdom.
Now, we're speaking about how the Democrats are catering more to the elite class and have sort of left working people in the dust. Do you see campaign finance and the constant need for fundraising as part and parcel to this?
Absolutely. That is part of the same story. And, it's a fortunate coincidence for the Democrats that the group that they decided after the Vietnam War was more virtuous and that they wanted to identify with was an upper class group. it's really lucky for them that things turned out that way. But it's funny that they made this decision before money was played such a huge role in politics. But look, it's a very happy coincidence, and so they are today very comfortable and doing very well as a party of the upper 10%. And that really is who they are. They and the Republicans represent different factions of the nation's elite.
And we're seeing now, something like the rest of the 90% are frustrated, and we've gotten to this election where we've got two candidates, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who are sort of vocalizing this and harnessing it into their campaigns. What do you see what you're talking about as attributable to the rise of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump?
Oh, my God. Yes. Look, inequality is getting worse and worse for a majority of people in America. They do these polls all the time, and these people say that the recession is still going on. Huge parts of this country are just falling apart. The social contract is basically over. You know, they're deindustrialized. This is what's happening to this country, and people are going to get angrier and angrier and angrier. And yes, both Bernie and, to a certain degree, Trump are speaking to that.
Do you see Bernie Sanders as does he stand for the traditional democratic values that you talk about in your book?
Ironically, he does. And I say ironically because he wasn't a Democrat up until very recently when he, you know, decided when he was going to run for president. But he does really represent the sort of New Deal tradition. It's kind of a rich irony when you think about it, that the guy who is most – who is closest to that kind of Franklin D. Roosevelt spirit is a guy who's barely even a Democrat. That's that tells you something right there.
Why do you think black people support the Democrats so overwhelmingly?
Oh, I think probably a big part of it is fear and hatred of the Republicans. I mean, there's a lot of people that are like that. That's a really common problem.
They're not Republicans, so it'll whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. They're not gonna vote for those guys. And by the way, you could say the same thing about lots of Democratic groups, organized labor. You know, what are they going to do, sign up with Scott Walker? You know, of course not. You know, do you remember the Clinton-era expression, they've got nowhere else to go? And they would say this. Clinton used to he used to go out of his way to insult leaders of various Democratic constituencies, the most memorable being Jesse Jackson, right? But that was always the saying, they've got nowhere else to go. And he did the same thing to organized labor with NAFTA. But what's funny is all of these white working class voters, a large number of them who used to be Democrats, they have found somewhere else to go.
And that being?
Trump.
You wrote a column recently sort of saying that the media has gotten it wrong and they don't understand Trump's support base. Can you explain what the media is getting wrong about Trump's support base?
Well, it wasn't that they're wrong so much as that they were ignoring something that he was doing. Mm-hmm. I should preface this by saying I'm not a Trump fan. This man disgusts me and disturbs me in nearly every way. The way he ties his shoes to, you know, the things that he said, everything about him bugs me. Okay, but that's the media was focusing on these kind of outrageous and bigoted and intolerant things that he says. You know, and I was watching this and thinking, well, that's not a good enough explanation for why you have this, you know, why this man is winning, is doing so well, why people like him so much. Look, at least he has singled out and put his finger on the thing that drives a lot of working class people crazy, which is, you know, our government negotiates these deals like NAFTA or the Trans-Pacific Partnership that are obviously designed to harm them and to prosper other groups.
But how do they know that when they're 5,000 pages long? And then
you know how they know about what's in the trade deals? Because their bosses tell them.
Mm. So getting back to the Democratic Party, how can they return to traditional Democratic values? And what, in your mind, does that look like?
I think it will happen. I think it's got to happen. You know, we're moving more and more to a crisis point all the time. We came to that crisis point in 2008. We came to the turning point. We just didn't turn. You know, because Obama did not take the opportunities that afforded him to steer this country in a different direction. And by the way, which everyone thought he was going to do. And because of that, he's, as he likes to say, kicked the can down the road a piece, right? And it's going to this problem is not going to go away anytime soon. So it remains to be seen exactly how this will unfold. I'll point one thing out here, that the Democratic establishment, they are very content with themselves. They're not anxious to join Bernie Sanders' political revolution. They're doing very well. They are very satisfied with things as they are. And that entire system has to come down, I'm afraid.
That was Thomas Frank, author of Listen Liberal, talking with Radio Times producer John Ahrens. And that's it for the first Our Radio Times. Do stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.